Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to the Game Podcast. This is Hugh Woozencroft. Today, lots to discuss. What happens if England players take the knee? Is there a watershed moment for mental health in football? We'll talk about football's darkest secret as well as, of course, who would want to boycott the World Cup? Also, who prefers their country to their club? Help me through it all. Jonathan Northcroft, Gregor Robertson and Tom Roddy. How are you guys?
Hi, Hugh. How are you doing?
I am very well. It's quite a serious podcast for us today, though. Some topics for us to get our teeth into. We'll start on the road to Qatar. It's begun. The qualifiers are underway in Europe, of course. But what exactly are the streets paved with? Who buy and at what cost? Despite the proven corruption that led to the award of the 2022 World Cup, the competition will still take place in the oil-rich Arab state of less than 3 million in population. But the event has been overshadowed by claims of structural racism, coercive labour conditions, of course, the anti-LGBT stance and laws in the country, the lack of transparency over a reported 6,500 migrant worker deaths since they were awarded the World Cup, 37 of those linked to the building of stadia. Of course, women's rights in the country are still restricted. We could go on, but last night, Norway's players made a stance on this. They wore T-shirts before their World Cup qualifier, saying, human rights on and off the pitch. Martin Odegaard of Arsenal and Real Madrid said he believes that many players will want to contribute to the conversation and take a stance. Norway's FA have now set up a committee to examine their concerns. The Netherlands also this week speaking about it. Johnny, taking a step back, looking at the entire thing, the award of the World Cup in Qatar, can we still believe that it's happening?
No, I mean, it's still surreal, the thought that we're going to go to a small, hot country with no history of football to play, you know, the world's greatest football tournament. I was in Qatar for the Club World Cup last year with Liverpool, and it was surreal, the experience of going out to see the World Cup final stadium that's being built. I mean, they're constructing an entire kind of mini city around it with roads and infrastructure all the way out, and you know, the feeling that they're doing all of this just to host 4 weeks of football is absurd, and that's before you get to this more serious matter, which is of course the human rights issues and the thought that that football in the world is going to ignore those and just try and crack on with the football tournaments doesn't sit very well. Still doesn't seem like it really is happening. And you know, Sepp Blatter, I think his ban was extended by FIFA just a couple of days ago. This feels like the last remnants of an old way of doing things that we're kind of stuck with. Then again, is Infantino any better? I don't know. The whole thing doesn't seem right. And now, of course, we're beginning the World Cup qualifiers, and it is becoming very real, but we shouldn't be going to Qatar.
The Norway players may well agree. Other football associations may well agree. Shouldn't be going to Qatar, Tom Roddy. What do you think? Because FIFA have had to pressure the country to increase their standards since the award in 2010, and there are still question marks here.
Yeah, totally. Hugh, I mean, you look back to, there were some reforms brought in, human rights reforms brought in 2019 in Qatar, but I mean, before then, frankly, you're almost in kind of Jim Crow territory for a lot of migrants there, because they had to get permission from their sponsors to change employment. And more often than not, the sponsor was the employer. So, it felt like Jim Crow law almost before 2019. It feels like Johnny said, the kind of surreal nature of this 4-week tournament, 10 years of building and construction, and the cost, the huge cost in so many ways for this tournament. It feels a lot like this sudden, maybe it's not sudden, but this feeling of kind of sports washing suddenly, where, you know, we're seeing a lot of fights going out to Saudi Arabia and the kind of money talks there. And it's just a really ugly situation. And I think the Norway players wearing the t-shirts, it's good to open up many people's eyes to it. It's got us talking about it today, and it seems incredible to think that, you know, 3 years ago we had the Prime Minister talking about England boycotting the World Cup in Russia because of the Salisbury poisoning, and there's not really been any possibility of or discussion around it happening when you've got 6,500 migrants losing their life. My only experience of Qatar so far was 2019, actually, and that was a connection flight in the airport, which was a similar, it felt like a Westfield. It's this huge, and that's what I think the experience is going to be for the tournament. You know, it's going to be this impressive, there's going to be hugely impressive infrastructure, but it's so tainted, absolutely tainted.
I think people have spoken in the past about sport selling its soul. I mean, this is probably going to be the ultimate, probably the biggest example of sports washing we have seen so far. I think it's unlikely that will happen with the Olympic Games, but the Football World Cup is certainly the next best thing. And it's almost a green light to these strong, very authoritarian states on the global stage, Gregor. Is it? I mean, do you agree with me? Do you think it's the ultimate sports washing event?
Yeah, I kind of agree with John. I think you just have to hope that this is the nadir of FIFA's kind of, the bribes and corruption allegations. Homosexuality is illegal there. They've literally transposed the tournament to a different time of year and right in the middle of the season. There's so many things, but clearly the treatment, an average of 12 people dying a week in the time since they've been awarded the tournament. That is the most serious issue. And I don't think, Johnny was kind of saying, yeah, we're going to go along and for 4 weeks and focus on football. I don't think it's going to work for them. I think it's just, we've just started the World Cup qualification campaign and already we're talking about this, and this is not going to go away. I think it's only going to highlight their human rights record and many other things. I think that footballers no longer going to kind of trot out platitudes about it. We've already seen footballers are more willing to take a stand for things they believe strongly. And we saw Gini Wijnaldum say things. Odegaard came out and spoke about it, and I'm sure many other players will.
Yeah, John Stones, I think, said that the England players do want to, have a conversation about that tournament as well. And that's a Manchester City player talking.
Well, yeah, that kind of highlights the complication in all this too. And you have to, Odegaard maybe has to remember that the stadium he plays in for Arsenal is called the Emirates. This is a complicated subject. But the main thing is, I think what's changed is that footballers feel kind of empowered enough to have these conversations, where in the past they wouldn't have, I don't think.
Tom, do you think players can affect the situation with a possible boycott, or just merely stating that it's a possibility?
I think both has a huge effect on the situation, because it opens up people's eyes to what is going on. It's it slightly moves into the conversation of what's been going on over the last year with the taking of the knee in football, because people are rightly saying that, you know, it's all Wilfried Zaha. I know that we're going to talk about the taking of the knee, but Wilfried Zaha stopped doing it, saying it's an empty gesture. And the reason that I'm drawing a parallel there is because wearing a T-shirt, is that enough? Or how much more powerful would it be to boycott the competition? I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to it, to England withdrawing and boycotting the 2022 World Cup, because the situation is horrific. The situation and the numbers behind and the stories behind what's happened there to make this competition, this tournament happen. And it just feels like, it feels, in a way, Russia on the Russian World Cup on steroids a little bit, in a way, because, you know, everyone, I wasn't at the Russia World Cup, but the those that were speak of a brilliant experience and everything, but the streets were cleaned up. It was the issues in that country were the cracks in that country were papered over, you know, and this is you can't ignore the issues with Qatar, because I just picture sitting in a stadium and thinking of the amount of people that died building it for a football match.
Johnny, what happens, do you think, if 1, 2, 3 major nations decide to start talking about a possible boycott? Could that snowball?
It could, and I think it would have to be major nations. I mean, I've been thinking about the whole scenario that I think that Norway have probably started this conversation quite effectively. And, you know, is boycotting the right thing, or is it actually doing something else which might have a greater impact? And I mean, look, I think this the context, or the starting point, and the lads have sort of touched on it, is yes, we live in a morally compromised world. You know, our own government has arms deals with certain regimes with bad human rights records. Sport has been in deep with certain locations. You know, Tom mentioned the boxing in Saudi Arabia. The Club World Cup's been in Qatar for the last 2 years. It's in deep. You know, our football clubs are sponsored by places with poor human rights records. And also, I have to make the point that a lot of these migrant deaths are around infrastructure, and that's talking about building hotels and highways and stuff. Anyone that goes to Dubai on holiday, anyone that goes to that region on holiday, is probably going to be taking advantage of facilities that have been built using the same migrant worker system with the poor rights records that we see with the World Cup. So that's just to say, look, we live in this very compromised world where once you start talking about the Qatar World Cup, or let's say Manchester City and Abu Dhabi, or whatever it is, people will always say, yeah, but what about this? What about this? What about this? That's be a starting point somewhere if we want to change it. Yet again, it does seem to fall on football to be at the sharp end of this thing. And the World Cup can be a starting point in changing our relationship, not just football's relationship, but maybe the whole relationship with you know, what human rights and the importance of that and so on. But is a boycott going to be the thing that would change it, or would going to the tournament and doing, you know, it's all about the optics, World Cups. What they want to present is this is a modern Qatar, this is fantastic, this is wonderful, world's great. Go and change the optics. Go and protest at the games. You know, if there was a sort of gesture, a sort of taking the knee style gesture that each team did, or big teams did before every match, and FIFA wouldn't be able to stop it, what a comment that would be, what a symbol that would be. A bit like, you know, Black Power salute at the 68 Olympics, you know. So if I actually think that would be more effective, if there was a gesture that players wanted to come up with, or nations wanted to come up with, it might be the open fist, which was originally a human rights symbol before Tommy Smith and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know what it would be, but to me that would actually seem to be more effective than a boycott. A boycott, I think, ends up having a sort of, you know, countries that do, countries that don't situation, them and us, And as I say, what it doesn't do is spoil the lovely optics that FIFA want to have. So that I think Norway, what they've done has been probably more effective, let's say, than if they just refused to play their game or pulled out of the tournament straight away. They've started a conversation.
As Wijnaldum said as well, you know, none of the players decide where the World Cup's hosted, and they come around every 4 years. You know, you've got to think of how many opportunities a footballer gets to do that. I mean, this is a small, insignificant matter in the kind of broad spectrum of this conversation. But I think Johnny's right. It doesn't fall upon football. Football can highlight these issues probably more acutely by actually being there.
We will see if any teams make that decision, any players specifically make that decision. I can imagine if, you know, a Lionel Messi or a Cristiano Ronaldo comes out publicly and makes a stance, even if they still go to the tournament, that might change the public's feelings towards it as well. There's a long way to go until that World Cup, and this conversation, I'm sure, will continue. But since we're on the topic of football needing to do more, let's slightly change our angle. This week, the nation was confronted with the deeply emotional, the harrowing tales of victims of child sexual abuse in the game. The BBC's three-part series, Football's Darkest Secret, aired. Since 2016, there have been convictions for former youth football coaches such as Barry Bunnell, Bob Higgins and George Ormond. We heard personal testimony from the likes of Andy Woodward, formerly of Crewe Alexandra, former Spurs, Manchester City and England player Paul Stewart, among many others. It was a distressing watch. It was an emotional watch. It was an important piece of work, Tom.
Yeah, totally. I mean, the first thing to stand out for me was the bravery of these men to voice in graphic and uncomfortable detail what happened to them. And it is uncomfortable, and it's not nice. It's not pleasant to watch, but it's not meant to be. You know, these are men who are talking to ensure that any other perpetrators are caught, to ensure these things don't happen again. And I think the nucleus of all these abusers is power, and in different ways as well with groomers, because, you know, Barry Bennell, you've got the man that everyone in the family of these boys liked. I think one of the former footballers said in the programme that their dads wanted to be like them, the mums and sisters fancied them, but there was this brutal violence towards the boys. And then in the case of Bob Higgins, you've got he groomed them and made them love him. There were these romantic love letters that they would write to him. And I think the parts of the programme where they talk in detail about what happened are harrowing and horrible. But for me, the most painful part was actually the missed opportunities that they had to catch them. But I mean, I would just recommend anyone who hasn't watched it to watch it, because it can't have been easy for them to talk about this.
As I'm speaking, I've just seen that Crewe Alexandra's long-standing chairman, John Bowler, has quit following last week's publication of the Sheldon Report. He's apologised to players sexually abused by the club's ex-youth coach, Barry Bunnell. I'll just read you part of his statement. He says, "I today have informed my fellow directors I intend to stand down from my position as a board member of Crewe Alexandra Football Club with immediate effect. I always intended to do so following the conclusion of the Sheldon Review into child abuse in football. As the only person left with an association to that era, I truly believe it was important for me to see it through to the conclusion. I'm satisfied with the findings of the review that found the club did not have any knowledge of Barry Bunnell's heinous crimes. I will always be deeply appalled and sorry that those young players and their families suffered at the hands of this evil predator. I personally and sincerely apologise to them all for their suffering. Crewe Alexandra is a community-based football club with good people. I apologise to all of our supporters that the name of the club has been tarnished. I've worked on the formation of a new board. I know they will do all they can to move the club forward. Our academy remains one of the finest in the country. We have every confidence in our safeguarding policies and procedures. There is always room for improvement as a club, and we will welcome the future recommendations of the Sheldon Review." Gregor, this Sheldon review last week found institutional failings within the Football Association as well, saying it was too slow to put sufficient measures in place between 1995 and the year 2000. I don't know if you've seen the documentary, but watching it, there was a sense that for many of the people involved, it may not have been as dark a secret, as deep a secret as sort of people now may think. You know, lots of the children, the players involved, saying that there was sort of, you know, there was this coach and that coach that parents wouldn't, you know, want a child to be near, you know, but it was never really brought to the fore. And football as a whole has, of course, let these people down, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it was just astonishing when you saw the Dispatches program that was aired a couple of decades ago. That was, and the kind of silence it was met with, and the bravery of the people who did speak out at that time, and they felt like they were completely abandoned and ignored afterwards. It was just remarkable. I thought it was one of the most moving, kind of powerful programs I've seen in many, many years. And I'm kind of pleased to hear that John Bowler's decided to go, because Cruz, after, I completely echo what Tom said, the bravery of these guys was remarkable, and that's the biggest takeaway from the program. But after that, for me, it was the appalling way that Crewe in particular dealt with the fallout from this, and that was almost kind of underlined with Matt Lawton had a story last week where they essentially tried to suppress Dave Artell, the manager, who basically made an apology on behalf of the club as the manager, the figurehead of the club. And the press officer afterwards rang around the people that were involved, or just the local press, saying, look, we don't want this to go national. And they said in Matt's story that they were uncomfortable with the sorry thing. So, they've always been, it's been described as kind of by some of the survivors as mealy-mouthed apologies. And, you know, the thing that this programme really raised was that it's not really easy to stand by their position of complete ignorance. You know, it's like, and I know that as they said in their statement, that the investigations have shown that there's no evidence that they knew anything, but there were people who said on the program that there were certainly plenty of rumors, and a former board member, in fact, convened a meeting about it, and it was put to certain officials at the club, and nothing happened. So as Tom says, there's so many missed opportunities, and all because really of the cost that would have been to the football club, or to reputations, or to football's reputation. That's at the root of the FA's kind of silence at this, from this all this as well. So Crewe's a club I played for 18 months, and I just absolutely feel that it's so important that John Bowler has stood down now, because the club would be tainted forevermore until the people who were, it's just astonishing that the people who were at the club involved in positions of power at that time are still there and have still been the ones who've tried to kind of bundle their way through this. So they have to go. And I'm delighted this has started to happen now, because Crewe, you know, for Crewe to kind of move forward, and for football to move forward, I think, you know, there has to be apologies, and there has to be certain, I think we all know that children are much safer now in football clubs' care. But that certainly was not the case back in the day. This programme showed in harrowing detail.
I think what Greg is alluding to there is that there has been a sustained lack of accountability from within the game, Jonathan. And that is the saddest thing, I think, to see. And maybe he's right. Things have changed, of course. But I think we still see a sport that is too scared to take responsibility for its mistakes in many avenues.
I agree with that. I think we see a sport that still puts its own image or whatever above those the needs and rights of and lives of individuals. Sadly, I think football still moves to protect itself. And John Bowler's resignation is a bit of a start, but there has been precious few takings of institutional responsibility, really, not by individuals. And I worked on the story last week on one of the abusers, Kit Carson, who was at Cambridge and Peterborough and Norwich and employed Bob Higgins even after he'd been tried for child sex abuse. The football just carried on. There's this feeling still trying to carry on to an extent without to kind of try and say that this was in the past, these were these individuals, but it's all fine now. And the Sheldon report, I think Matt Dickinson said very accurately, it's impressive in its breadth, but quite shallow in its detail because of its breadth. I felt the Sheldon report was kind of set up almost to fail in a way, in that it was, you know, the idea is we're going to deal with child sex abuse by commissioning a review that looks at a historical period and doesn't look beyond or outside of that. So what you got, the review's done incredible work in trying to look at all these things, but it hasn't been able to really investigate things, really hold in, you know, people who are still at clubs to account. And the tenor of the report again and again boils down to this individual abuser did this. The club says it didn't know. We accept that. It couldn't really have known. And it was in the past. Move on. You know, the FA comes out and apologizes. We're really sorry. Institutional failings. You know, it was all in the past. And a feeling that, you know, as I say, individuals who were working at the time, whose responsibility it was to oversee the welfare of young players, are still in place. So John Bowler going is a start, but I think there's still a lot of questions. I think there's still a lot of questions as to, you know, who really is taking responsibility for this. It hasn't sat really easily the last week or two with me. The victims, you know, as the lads have said, whose bravery shines through in those programs, I think are still left feeling this hasn't entirely been dealt with.
You know, this is quite a heavy topic, but one of the reasons we kind of thought we'd speak about it is just to urge anyone who's not watched this program to do so. I think because, you know, Danny Taylor, who the journalist who deserves huge credit as well for breaking these stories and doing so much work, he said that I think on average, well, the kids, whoever, somebody's worked out that 1 in 8 survivors come forward. So still, this is not even scratching the surface, probably. And I have to say that once watching this programme, I had in the back of my mind that I could quite possibly have been in these people's situation. I played for Celtic Boys Club when I was a kid, and two people who were present during my time at Celtic Boys Club have since been convicted of child abuse. The bravery of these guys, and seeing the effect on the rest of their lives as well, was really, really moving. And yeah, just to anyone who hasn't watched it, I would very much recommend they do so.
It's called Football's Darkest Secret. You can get it on the BBC iPlayer right now. It's a hard-hitting but important documentary piece of work, and some very, very brave, brave stories from families involved, and the people, of course, involved as well. You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. On the way, we will talk about taking a knee and if it happens with the England squad. How would you feel about it? But remember, you can give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast from if you're enjoying the game. And also, you can get more of our award-winning journalism by getting yourself a digital subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times. You can get it on all of your devices right now. If you sign up today, you'll also get 1 month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started. Will England's players take a knee? It's been, I guess, a divisive thing in football since last summer. A bit like Colin Kaepernick in the NFL started back in 2016, the World Cup qualifiers give the players who have been taking the knee momentarily before kickoff in their Premier League and EFL matches the chance to kneel during the national anthem, some feeling that would be massively disrespectful or totally change the whole point of what taking the knee stands for, but it brings the issue of social injustice, I think, to the fore. It would certainly be more impactful. Gareth Southgate says his players are discussing it. He also says he's happy that his players are getting together to discuss this. So he does think it's an important issue. But Johnny, I just imagine what the newspapers, the radio stations, breakfast TV might be like on Friday if an England player were to kneel against social injustice during the English national anthem.
Yes, I can imagine the reaction, and I probably wouldn't want to read readers' comments beneath any article of any paper, because it brings out the best and worst of humanity. But I think we've got to go back to where taking the knee came from with Kaepernick, and it was specifically a gesture during the American national anthem, specifically at the time to make a comment that the US as a country, as his country, wasn't dealing with racial injustice or racial justice, whatever you want to say, properly. Violence towards, by the police, towards young black people and the entire American kind of system. That, it was a specific protest about his country, and that's why he did it during the anthem. So for players, England players, to do it during the their national anthem would be, I guess, a specific comment about Britain and where Britain is. And I think that's where there would be a huge debate, and I think that's where there'd be a lot of different opinions from the players. The last thing I want to do is sit here and tell players what they should do, what they should think, because I can't relate to being a 25-year-old young black footballer in England, or you know, that's not my place to make that comment. But I just think that we probably have to remember where the gesture came from and what it would mean to do it during the anthem. I would applaud anything they wanted to do, because the idea of players standing up against injustice sits very well with me. I think since the first taking the knee, which I think Tyrone Mings was and David McGoldrick were behind, so Tyrone Mings is involved for England tonight. It has, for better or worse, kept the subject in the front of people's minds and kept people talking about it. It's up to them what they want to do, and that's what Gareth Southgate has also said. I just think we need to talk about we need to keep talking about the subject and hopefully get to a place where it's not football that's just having to be at the front of highlighting these things.
Tom, what do you think? What will the reaction be like if an England player takes the knee, and I guess what would the consequences be?
I don't particularly like to think about it, to be honest, Hugh. But I can only really echo everything that Johnny said. I think one thing I do think is that the Gareth Southgate saying that it needs to be a sort of, it's going to be a unified stance either way, whatever they do, is really important. And the reason for that is because I think, I don't know if you remember, but when you had the Formula One drivers who were taking the knee, and you had them lined up before the race, and some of them taking the knee and some not, and it looked like this visual image of division huge division in the image of it. And I think this part of taking the knee in England in Britain was as to kind of reflect Black Lives Matter, and it all goes back to an element of solidarity. And of course, Johnny mentioned earlier about the 68 Olympics, and you had the Black Power salute of Smith and Carlos, and then there was also the Australian sprinter Peter Norman, wasn't there, who wore the badge that day, and he ended up being a prior in Australia. But it goes back to solidarity. So I think it definitely has to be unified in whatever they do. And again, I'm not going to say it should be done or it shouldn't be done. I think it was one thing that we'll say is that it was when Aston Villa and Sheffield United did it for that first game, it was one of the most powerful things, probably the most powerful thing I've ever seen live in a football match, in sport. And I think that I remember Harry Kane saying that if one person sees us doing it and asks why we're doing it and they are informed and educated by it, then that's a positive thing.
I'm slightly torn about that, about the whole unified approach line of thinking. But what if Wilfred Zaha played for England? There's a strong possibility then that you might be asking someone to do something that they don't want to do. I understand that if there's possibly, you know, say there's two players who decide to do so, yes, Hugh, you're absolutely right. The consequences from them and from some aspects of the British media and the British public would be pretty chastening for them, I think. But I actually think it should be within everyone's right to do what they feel.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Is right, and then it's up to them to explain their reasons for doing so. So, again, I understand that certainly Gareth Southgate's reasoning behind wanting it to be a unified approach, but I'd also think that these conversations could be quite interesting. I would imagine there'd be some England players who would like to do it, and some who possibly don't.
I really agree with you, Gregor, about that. And Zaha came into my mind when I was thinking about this idea of it being unified, because he released a very eloquent statement which gave very good reasons for not doing it, that it felt like an empty gesture. And it has, you know, the said about the Villa game and Villa Sheffield United game, and it was so powerful, and gradually it's not become, seeing it has not become as powerful. It's become something that the players do before each game. It's just,
some people agree with that and some don't. I mean, it's their own reasoning.
It was just this idea of this visual image of, if you're taking a knee, then you support something, and if you're stood up, you don't. And I'm not saying there's huge nuance in it, and I'm not saying that if you're stood up, you don't support these things. But what I'm saying is that it may have appeared to some people that if you don't take the knee, that's where you are. I'm saying, you know, it's the division side of it that it I'm not saying that. That taking a knee is divisive. I'm saying that it looks like there's a huge division there between where the morals of these two people stand, if you're taking a knee or if you're not.
Maybe what we could agree on is that the football as a whole, the game isn't doing enough.
Yeah, we're talking about this more than we're talking about what the bigger issues. Everyone says we need to talk about much deeper issues in racism, but really, no one really buries into how very deeply what they are and what can be done.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, irrespective of someone's political opinion or personal opinion about what Britain does to, you know, address social injustice and race and so on, we could maybe all, or the players could certainly agree that the game's not doing enough. You only need to look at another season where UEFA seemed to deal very weakly with instances of racial abuse in their own club competitions, and we've been talking about FIFA and Qatar, and you know, there's an element there of racial injustice, because rights for people from certain parts of the world seem to be greater than migrant workers from Asia in those places. So we could maybe agree that the game's not doing enough, and some form of protest that takes place during UEFA anthems or FIFA anthems might be a starting point. But beyond that, I it's down to the individual. Totally agree with Gregor. But there will be more debate and disagreement once the point is broadened out to beyond just the game.
What do you think, Hugh?
Well, look, I think it's one of those. I think when we reflect on what we spoke about earlier with Qatar, you know, if these players are serious around, addressing injustice, whether that be social here, whether that be human rights in Qatar, that they really have to do something. It coming during the national anthem clearly changes things. We saw what happened to Colin Kaepernick, never played a game in the NFL pretty much again. So we can see what it can do to someone's career. But it boils down to the individual and where their commitment is around it, really. I imagine I probably would, you know, if I was in the England team. But obviously I'm very, very removed from being in that position. But the national anthem is the point where you actually, that's the thing, if you look across the world, that has actually made taking the knee much more striking, you know, because that is saying this thing that is meant to represent all of us, this song that we're all meant to stand with our hand on our hearts about, actually means something different to me than it does to you. This country means something different to me than it does to you. That's the message of social injustice. My England is not your England. You know, and that I think is the point of it. The players that take the knee are probably the ones that understand that, and maybe the players who don't aren't. But I wouldn't have any judgment on people that don't. I don't have any judgment on people that do. I think it's up to the individual. But for those players that think it might be getting watered down just before the match to do it for those 10 seconds, and this is their opportunity to put it back in the forefront and actually make it mean something a hell of a lot more. It would not be forgotten, I don't think. It would never really be forgotten if a player did it during the national anthem. So, that player would have to probably live with being booed at every football ground they play at for the rest of their career. But I think in terms of the conversation around social injustice, this would be the thing that meant that anyone who has currently avoided the conversation about it wouldn't be able to. That, I think, would be the power of it. So I wanted to talk about it because I just think it would be a massive, massive story, really, if a player did it. And when I heard Gareth Southgate say the players were discussing it, I thought, well, what's there to discuss? They've been doing it every week in the Premier League. And then I suddenly thought, is it that some of them want to take the knee during the national anthem? And it's important that they discuss that beforehand for those players that take the knee and those players that don't, because there could be ramifications for both, really. I'm intrigued to see what happens before the game. I think it would be a massive moment for the country. For some reason, it's one of those examples as well that you just go, why is football so effective compared to other things in sort of getting into that national dialogue in this country? I mean, we do love the game so much. We are so passionate about it that you almost think if Raheem Sterling was, I don't know, if he went to Buckingham Palace and he was getting an OBE or something, I don't know, and he wore something that spoke about social injustice, or he did something there to make a point about social injustice, it probably wouldn't be as striking as if he did it in an England football shirt, which is you know, that shows you the power of those three lions. So, it's the opportunity for, I'm not circling, singling him out, or for any of those players, black, white or otherwise, to sort of make a stance, and it would be really interesting to see who decides.
An opportunity in an empty stadium, that may not come again.
Yeah, that is true as well.
Don't want to predict what the reaction would be, but I think, you know, certainly a fair swathe of the crowd would not be too best pleased with that, I would imagine. So, well, who knows? I don't know. I'm predicting there, but certainly I think we know this is something that's been hugely divisive in the population at large, and as you say, it'd be very interesting to see what the players decide to do.
Who knew the power of taking a knee? All these protests, all these marches over the years, you know, riots and stuff, and all you needed to do was take a knee to shape the national discourse. Who knew? But it would be a watershed moment. And I think earlier this week, we had another watershed moment, really, this around the discussion on mental health. Sadly, the Fiorentina boss, Cesare Prandelli, stood down from the role. He gave an open, honest, really astounding and heartbreaking description of how he was feeling in leaving the role. The former Italy, Roma and Valencia manager put out a statement saying that he had gone through a profound period of distress, which was preventing him from being who he really was. He went on to say, over the past few months, a dark cloud has developed inside of me, changing the way I see things. He says, I'm aware that this could be the end of my career as a coach, but I have no regrets and I don't wish to have any. The world I've been a part of for my whole life probably isn't right for me anymore. I no longer see myself in it. I've certainly changed, but the world is moving faster than I thought too. That's why I believe the time has come for me to stop being swept along, stop for a while and rediscover my true self once again. I've never really seen a statement as sort of open as this before. I thought it was just amazingly brave, Gregor. What did you make of the statement?
Yeah, it was kind of very eloquent and beautifully written as well. It was hugely open and candid. I think the saddest thing is he said that, you know, I understand this might be the end of my career, and I think that probably that line in itself will tell you why anyone who, any manager or otherwise who's felt this way before or suffered with depression or, you know, any mental health issues has not done this, because they feel that it could be kind of the end of their career, and there's still that stigma about it. I think that is changing. I think we have to say that is changing. I would like to hope it's changing anyway. I don't know. He certainly seems to have a question mark about that. But yeah, just very, 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 very brave and eloquent, I thought. And, you know, I think this is a positive step forward that a manager, a very hugely experienced manager of, you know, of his age as well, that's willing to come out and be so open about this.
Does it help us, Tom, understand the pressure of football, of being in a high profile role like this?
Yeah, I think it does. And what Gregor said at the end there, you know, it's a 63-year-old man who has years, decades of experience in sport. And it then makes me think of the young guys coming through who are not... you know, they're trying to find who they are as human beings before football comes into it, and the pressure that is put on them. And I think this is a reminder for that all these people we're watching and judging and having these knee-jerk reactions and judgments to on how they perform on a football field. There is so much pressure that comes with that, and it's difficult to handle that. And I think, you know, we've this pretty much this whole podcast has been us talking about people who are doing the right thing rather than the easy thing, and it feels like Prandelli's statement is a little bit of that. You know, he could have just resigned and not said these things, but he did. And I think the important thing, like the football's darkest secrets and the players coming forward to that, it shows other people that you can talk about that. You can talk about your experiences, and you know, because we have history in football, because it is a reflection of society. We have a history of losing people who we didn't know were struggling with certain situations as well. So I think him, Prandelli, speaking about it should show people that they can and should feel comfortable to speak about it.
Jonathan, do you think more managers will speak about their experiences like this?
I'm not sure if they will, for the reasons that you know, we've been talking about, that this may well end Prandelli's top-level career. And I think about Martin Ling, who has spoken bravely about his mental health issues and hasn't really worked. I think he did go back to Orient after doing so, but that didn't last very long. I think the game's still... may stigmatize such people, sadly, and maybe there will be a reluctance to speak out. But I think, as Tom and Gregor were saying, it's incredibly brave by Prandelli. This is a really top manager being brave enough to talk about these issues, and it will maybe at least help people who are going through something similar in the game, and maybe help people understand the pressures of football management, the goldfish bowl nature of it, the incessant nature of it, maybe the lack of help there is. So he's done something, you know, he's had a great coaching career, but he's also done something that he'll be remembered for in crafting that statement and taking this action and being so open about it.
Martin Ling, as Johnny was saying there, you know, he's the only person really I can personally think of that said this, and he has said he's actually director of football at Leyton Orient now. They are, I think, as a football club, they've been really good in supporting him, and he's done a good job for them too, actually, in terms of being there when they got promoted back to the Football League. But he before that, he did speak about the stigma of it, and he felt that, you know, that is kind of future job prospects considerable harm. So as I'm saying that, I still think that was an intriguing line. It was an intriguing statement, actually. I mean, he was talking about kind of not, I no longer see myself in this world anymore. But he's also talking about the world is moving faster than I thought too. There's some kind of interesting lines in the statement about, I don't know, certainly his own struggles, but perhaps the way that football is changing as well. I'm not sure. I think there's more to be heard from him about this, and I hope he does speak as candidly as he has in the statement.
This is also an era where it's kind of changed, hasn't it? Because this is an era where footballers and managers are more kind of protected than ever in the terms of the people around them, the systems that clubs have to protect players and coaches and staff. But at the same time, it's also an era in which social media is, you know, you can so easily be abused if you're on social media. And it's speaking of another documentary, which isn't related to football or sport at all, there was recently the Channel 4 documentary on Caroline Flack and her experiences of social media addiction and the abuse she got, and she just couldn't avoid it. It was kind of an obsession. And so it's as much as you're protected more these days, you're also more vulnerable to abuse.
I think it's a conversation that needs to continue, of course, and support is one major thing. Just finally on it, Gregor, from your perspective during your career, did people check on the manager? We often talk about checking on your players and man management from the manager to the players. Did anyone ever check on the boss?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I think, to be honest, I mean, throughout much of my career, I wouldn't really say anyone checked on the players either. I think this is pretty fast developing. As Tom says, there's more care and attention about these issues now given to players. But I would agree with you from what you're kind of alluding to there. I would say that managers probably are a blind spot. You're the man. You're the figurehead. You're the one in the firing line, and you know, I think you have to have a pretty good support network around you to help you deal with some of the stresses and strains of being a manager. Because you look at some of the. You know, someone like Steve Bruce, we were talking about last week, and some of the, you know, he must be in a very difficult position just now. And, you know, that's just one name to it. Being a manager, you are the man who takes the flak and who is in the firing line. So it's a very, very difficult position to be in sometimes.
We hope that Cesare Prandelli, we wish him all the best, and we hope that he is back in football and doing what he loves soon, if that is the thing that makes him healthy, ultimately. If not, then of course, best of luck with whatever is next. Look, finally, before we go, let's just spend the last few minutes on the World Cup qualifiers, which started last night. Alexander Mitrovic scored a double for Serbia against the Republic of Ireland, but it included a delightful chip over a languishing Mark Travers in goal. Mitrovic has 38 goals in his 62 caps for Serbia, and that got us thinking about the players who were probably better for their country than they were for their club. Jonathan, I'll start with you. Could one player stand out for you on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, it seems to happen to strikers more than anyone else, actually, for whatever reason. Maybe Gregor would have some idea. But you think about Miroslav Klose, who you know, did have a good club career, but nothing like his Germany career. Northern Ireland had David Healy and Kyle Lafferty, both of whom were lethal in the international stage. So maybe it's a strikers thing, but the name that actually came to my mind, just as a Scotland thing, but Colin Calderwood, who I reported on a lot when he was at the centre of Craig Brown's Scotland team. And he was unbelievable for Scotland. He had a good club career, but it didn't quite reach the levels of his international career. And maybe it was because in the international game, he had brilliant recovery pace. He was very good at sort of one-on-one duels. He seemed to sort of present foreign strikers with an issue that maybe they hadn't experienced too often, which is just as he was so tenacious in one-on-ones. I remember my colleague, late Kevin McCara, described him, you know, tackling Colin Calderwood was like tackling a giant pair of scissors because he was all kind of sharp elbows and kind of just hurt a player, and strikers didn't like to come near him in the international games. So yeah, the international game's different, and maybe just some players have got a skill set that is perfect for that.
Tom, anyone come to mind for you?
I think this is actually unfair on his club career, but it's probably just the numbers. Was Peter Crouch jumped out immediately because of the numbers that he recorded for England. I think a lot of Arsenal fans might say Granit Xhaka, probably, the performances he puts in for Switzerland. But I think the main one for me was probably Asamoah Gyan, because, I mean, he's Ghana's all-time top scorer, scored more goals than any other player from an African nation at World Cups. And yet his club career, his record was decent, but his club career wasn't, I don't think it reflects quite the same as it does for his country. I love this topic as well, Hugh. I was just going to say, I just love this topic, because it's great to see when players perform. I mean, Bale isn't in this category, but because he performed so well for his clubs, but it's so great when you see him playing for Wales.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Loads of suggestions came in online as well. Some talking about Paul Gascoigne, for example, as good as he was for his clubs. He was sort of more of an international legend. Lucas Podolski, a lot of people have said. We had a few David Healy's, who's already been mentioned. Karol Poborský of the Czech Republic. Milan Baros as well. Lucas Podolski. Jordan Pickford, someone said now as well. Look, there are quite a few. Gregor, did anyone stand out for you?
I think you could probably... I don't know, is it being harsh? I think you could chuck James McFadden in there. He's good, you know, he was good for Everton, he was good. He had a good club career, but he was just outstanding for Scotland. He was a talisman, I think you could. But also, I was looking at Fabio Grosso for Italy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was like 28 when he scored the 119th minute winner against Germany in a World Cup semi-final in 2006, and he scored the winning penalty. And he was playing for Palermo at the time, and he'd played for Perugia and a couple of lower league Italian clubs before that. You know, very kind of middling career. And then he got a move to Inter after that World Cup, and Lyon and Juve as well. But he, you know, never really hit those heights he did. And he played really well again in the Euros in 2008. So I think for his impact in that World Cup, definitely compared to the rest of his career, I'd say Grosso, yeah.
Do we add the likes of Lampard, Gerrard, Scholes to this, or are we allowed?
No, surely not.
I'll leave it there. The England fans are going to hammer me enough, I'm sure, so I'll leave it there. Pleasure to be with you as always, Tom Roddy, Gregor Robertson and Jonathan Norcross, and thank you for listening to the Game Podcast. Remember, right now you can get yourself a digital subscription to the Times and the Sunday Times. You'll get all of our award winning journalism on all of your devices, and remember, you sign up today, you will get 1 month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame to get started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.